equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettenayer, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. We've got a great show coming up for you today, emphasizing the food and the local economy aspects of the theme within greater energy context, of course. Now, should cities, towns, and villages let people grow food in the margins of urban areas, on lawns, in the right-of-way next to roads? How about in public parks? How about in churchyards? That's a question that city planner and designer Darren Nordahl takes up in his new book called Public Produce, The New Urban Agriculture. He's challenging local governments to let people grow food in urban settings. He tells us why. He'll be with us in the last half of this show, starting a little after 1:30. First, we're going to be talking with Rural Vermont. Rural Vermont has provided a lot of guests with commentary on this show. Executive Director, up until recently, Amy Schollenberger has been a frequent guest. Carl Russell, who's on the Board of Directors, is another frequent guest on this show. Rural Vermont works to create a Vermont local food system, which is self-reliant, and they've done such things as sponsor a bill to make it legal for farmers to sell enough quantities of raw milk that farmers say that they can keep a small dairy herd busy with that. They've worked on making it legal to compost and legal to slaughter chickens and other animals on your farm, in your yard, and sell what you slaughter to restaurants or at the farmers markets. And they've got a new director right now, a new executive director, just started a few months ago, and we're pleased to have him on board with us. Brian Moyer, welcome to Equal Time.
Well, thank you, Carl.
So, Brian, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background that you bring to rural Vermont?
Well, I've been farming myself. I come from Pennsylvania and have a 27-acre farm in southeastern Pennsylvania, about 60 miles northwest of Philadelphia, just north of the city of Reading. And my wife and I raised pasture poultry. We did up to about 2,500 meat chickens a year on grass. And we keep about 100 layers, and we'd also raise lambs and goats and some pigs. And we sold all directly to people at the farm and at a farmer's market that we had founded in the year 2000, that's still running. And then also sold through about four different CSAs. We would sell our eggs and meat products through these CSAs.
Hmm.
And then for the last 6 years, I've been on the board of PASA, which was the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, which is what got me into the rural Vermont circle. Some of the board members I knew through my work with PASA, and so when they were looking for a director, I was interested. So I've been following Rural Vermont's work for the last several years for the great work that Amy has been doing with the organization. And so I've been really, really thrilled that the board saw fit to see me pick up the mantle from Amy. And Amy has also been terrific in helping me trying to pass on her wealth of knowledge and the immense amount of work that she's done as the director for the last 6 years or so.
So
it's been really a great summer in making that transition.
So you're moving from a full-time farming job with your spare time, I suppose, on the board of the Pennsylvania Sustainable what's the acronym for PASA again?
Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, yeah.
Thank you. Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, to living in Montpelier, working full-time in this advocacy work.
So it's been a little bit of it's been quite a change. You know, it's a big life change. But I've been telling people, you know, so people were asking me if I was giving up farming. I said, no, and in particular, I'm not giving up on farming. It's just that the work that rural Vermont does is so important and actually makes echoes outside of the state of Vermont that that work makes farming that much easier down the road.
Mm.
So I find it just as important to be able to work for farmers as it is to be farming myself.
Mm. Well,
and just as rewarding, actually.
There is a perennial question: how are you going to keep them down on the farm when they've seen Montpelier?
It's a great town. I'm really enjoying it.
Mm. And you're pretty impressed with the Montpelier's farmers market, I understand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's been a delight to go to that on Saturday mornings and a highlight of my weekend. I've been bringing up stocks from Pennsylvania of what's from our freezer for meats and such, but still being able to get some great, one thing we didn't produce was beef, so I've been able to get some great local beef and the vegetable selection, just the variety of selection there is just amazing.
Hmm.
And I saw on, and I wish I could remember the website, I wasn't able to find it, but because a friend of mine emailed it to me when they knew I was moving to Montpelier, and that Montpelier's farmers market was voted one of the top 10 farmers markets in the country. So that was really, really impressive. And I would agree.
How does it compare with some of the farmers markets in the Philadelphia area?
I know of the markets in Philadelphia, and I know some of the organizations that have been key in putting those markets together, like Farm to City and Fair Food. And those are similar in that trying to bring the greatest variety from, you know, and the challenge in the Philadelphia market is probably the farms are pushed further out. You know, we have farming right up to the edge of, just outside of Montpelier.
Inside Montpelier, too.
Yeah, and inside Montpelier. So, you know, the farms can be right here. Farmers have to make quite an effort to go into the city of Philadelphia.
Hmm.
And so there's, that's a challenge, although there's a lot of great markets that have really taken off. Rittenhouse Square has been one of the most popular ones. But also using things like being able to accept support, women and children support, food support programs, and debit cards and things like that that make shopping at a farmer's market that much easier and also available to a variety of income structures. So,
mm-hmm. And Judy Wicks for the White Dog Cafe has been a frequent visitor to Vermont, and I think she's even been on the show. And the White Dog Cafe in Philadelphia has done a lot, it sounds like, to promote both farmers markets and use of food in local restaurants.
Arguably the leader in that, you know, with the work that she has really been committed to that. She was one of the, you know, she started this effort in, what, the 1970s with her cafe. And then has built it to where now the Fair Food Community Foundation is working with also other nonprofit organizations to create what we're starting to do here in Vermont, which is, you know, what are food center hubs that could distribute local food more so than just say farmer to consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know we're just starting to work with that with the Farm to Plate initiative that, you know, Rural Vermont had been involved in as well.
Right.
And so there's models for that. There's a way to do that. And I think that's what I've been kind of mandated to do by our board is taking all the great work that has been done in recent years legislatively and now seeing how we can do this on the farm, now how we can facilitate that. So to make sure that, as you said in your intro, that, you know, allowing more raw milk sales to occur, that they are occurring, and that it is a benefit to farmers, and that, especially in the midst of what is the biggest dairy crisis we've ever seen.
Mm.
And the same thing with the chicken bill, you know, are the farmers able to take advantage of these laws that we got, that we worked so hard to get passed?
What a remarkable
idea. What are the barriers to that and where we need to fine-tune that work?
What a remarkable idea to take a look at legislation after it's been passed to see if it's actually doing what you want it to do.
Yeah. And I was thrilled to do that and was really quite excited when first meeting with our, as you may know, you know, we have our farmer leader groups that we put together that give us our marching orders, as it were. So because we are doing the work for farmers, and we can't guess at this. And one of the greatest things that Amy has built and rural Vermont has built was this idea of creating these groups for farmers to participate in and tell us what they need. And so it was a early September meeting, so this is really new. This is just a month ago when we were meeting about what we were going to be working on, and the group was saying, I think we really got to see how this, how can we just increase local food sales on in Vermont? And then I took that to our board, and the board was saying, yeah, the same thing. Since the board is totally made up of farmers, they were agreed that, and that's where they came up with the idea, saying, State House is legislative, on-farm is facilitated, so go from legislate to facilitate. Not that we're not going to be in the State House or do any the legislative work that we've done, but it's just another focus, and this is where I think our strength, where our energies are going to go for 2010 anyway.
Well, I've seen Amy Schollenberger when she was executive director of Rural Vermont in action in the State House, and a lot of that involves just being in the committee rooms and monitoring what's going on, and of course bringing the right farmers and other people to the table to get the message across to the legislature.
Right.
What does it involve for you as executive director to facilitate the work on the farming level to implement these laws?
Well, that's what myself and the staff and the board are still working out. How we're going to do that, and a lot of it is awareness, holding some events. I mean, ideally we started that already with a really popular event. We've done several of these a month over the course of this year, which was the raw milk dairy classes, where it was on a farm that was selling raw milk, would hold classes of a small number of people, I think like a maximum of 10 or 12 people, that and they would show them how they could do more with their milk, how you can make cheese, how you can make butter, how you can make yogurt. And these have been very, very popular. And we have a waiting list of people who always want to attend these. So that's a kind of facilitation, because it's creating more customers. And the few that I've been at already, I've seen such a variety of people, from farmers who are just getting into selling raw milk, to consumers just getting an idea that they wanted to eat more locally, they were new to it, and some who have been part of the local food movement for a long time. So it was a great variety of people. So we're bringing more people into the local food movement and increasing, and that in turn increases more sales for that farmer too, because chances are they're going to sell more milk from those classes.
So these are classes that would help both people who want to buy raw milk and people who want to sell it?
Exactly.
Hmm.
So that's one way. So we're looking at on expanding that model.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Carl Etnayer. You're listening to Equal Time Radio. Our guest right now is Brian Moyer. He's a new executive director of Rural Vermont.
We have to find as many ways as possible to get as many voices back, so we have a clear direction on where we're going with this. Because it is different from what we've been doing the last several years, which is a clear objective of here's a problem, here's how we can fix it, and let's create legislation to do so. So this is much more heady and much bigger picture, and so a solution like that would just be one part of this, and we're calling it free enterprise farming is what we're calling this whole campaign.
Well, one of the things that I noticed about Rural Vermont when I shared office space with them for a little while was that they were very good at getting interns, particularly from the Vermont Law School, to come in, and they'd spend a summer studying the issues that they wanted to have before the legislature, just back and forth, getting information from what's happening in other states, researching possible objections to the legislation, and they put together some really ironclad briefs. I heard one of the members of the House Agriculture Committee, in response to one bill that Rural Vermont was supporting, saying this is the best prepared bill that I've ever seen in the legislature. What sort of intern help like that and harnessing of other resources in Vermont do you see for facilitating on-farm production of local food?
Yeah, I have one intern working with us right now, and she has been continuing the work that we've been doing over the summer on this, and that was trying to find the regulatory barriers that farmers have to cross to be able to bring food to market. Arguably, if I'm selling chicken And just for me to raise, process, sell chicken from my farm and take it to a farmer's market might be a couple of regulatory steps. And one may not have one to do with the other, or in other words, one might be through one agency, one might be through another, depending on whether it's from the agency agriculture or whether it's from a health department standpoint. And one may not tell the farmer that you've got to go, you also got to check with this department.
Hmm.
So in other words, it's not really always really clear what the regulatory steps are, especially for farmers selling protein products, meats, that what they have to do to get there. And so our interns have been researching that, and also especially in particular processed foods or value-added foods, I would say. Like, say, if you're making sausages or if you wanted to do more value-added milk products, what's entailed in doing that? If you want to make jams and jellies, what are the many regulatory processes you got to do that, from an inspected kitchen to who has to approve the product, what, and the various ingredients that are in the product? And so the bottom line is a farmer who wants to sell direct to a consumer has to do the same regulatory hurdles that a giant food corporation has to do, which is what the regulatory system is set up for. It's not set up for the small farm, but we have to adhere to those same regulations. So it's not a fair system.
Giant food corporations can afford to employ full-time employees to monitor the regulations and
exactly
and make sure that they're being followed.
Right, and comply.
Hmm.
And, you know, a farmer obviously can't do that. I mean, farming alone is a 25-hour-a-day job. And then also, by the way, you have to meet all these regulatory, from what your labels look like to what the ingredients are in the products to. Now, everybody wants to create, say, food, but arguably, if you're buying directly from the farmer, that is one level of compliance.
Hmm.
I mean, there's that relationship alone is a level of compliance. You're not going to buy from that farmer if you don't trust that person, don't have a relationship with that person, or been to their farm and agree with their farming practices. So what we're saying is, it's about time we have a tiered food system. And we kind of started that process with the raw milk. We have a two-tiered raw milk system.
Remind us how that works. That's really interesting.
Yeah, the tier one is the farmers that can now sell up to 50 quarts a day. And they're asked to follow certain guidelines in that, but you're not registering with the state and so on and so forth. Tier two is if you wanted to expand your marketplace in the marketplace. And this might be for someone with larger herds, and also especially if they're having trouble making ends meet because they're not getting their milk price and maybe want to start selling raw milk. So that you can sell up to 40 gallons a day with the option of also being able to do home delivery if you like.
And there you have to meet a little bit more stringent regulations.
Exactly, yeah. And then be registered, you have to be registered with the state.
Mm-hmm.
And have regular sampling done twice a month.
And then there is no tier three for raw milk. There is no unlimited option of selling unlimited quantities of
no,
raw milk.
No, mm-hmm. But arguably the most liberal raw milk law in the country, or at least one of them.
Mm.
So because it does create that economic opportunity for farms.
Mm. So where else would you like to see tiered legislation, tiered regulations?
Well, I think across the board regulatory a tiered system, depending on what level the farmer is selling at. If it's all direct to the consumer, that's obviously one tier of selling, and I think it should be a minimal regulation. And also, realistically, who's going to, you know, is there what the same as the raw milk? If you have a certain guidelines to follow, and that make perfect common sense, and there's a way to measure that. That's one tier. If it needs actual physical bodies, because to be able to inspect every single piece that goes along, well, you're talking about a greater quantity, and they're probably not that same relationship of the farmer and consumer. In other words, there's probably a retail sector in the middle, same as if you're buying at a store. Mm. You don't have that relationship with the farmer, but you know where that farm is.
Mm.
And that's another level. And then we have the ones where maybe it's more regional or it's more national, where there is absolutely no relationship you can possibly have with who manufactures that product.
Hmm. Are the regulations that you're looking at, are they both state and national ones?
Yeah, unfortunately. And I say unfortunately because when it gets to, and that's some of the frustrations our interns have run into, is when it gets to a federal level, there's nothing really the state can do because it cannot do less than what the federal mandates are.
Mm.
So that becomes a problem. So we are looking at, with some of our national affiliates, like the National Family Farmers Coalition and National Farmers Union, of who do work at a national level, of trying to put the word in the air, especially with the food safety law that's in being considered, which is making people very nervous, because here again it's a possibility of being one size fits all legislation.
Tell us about that food safety law. I've heard some scary stories about it, but I don't know how true they are.
Well, that's a problem too, because there's nothing for anybody to read.
Mm.
And so we all can go by either what we hear. Now, PASA, the organization I come from, has been one of 20 sustainable agriculture organizations who was involved in making sure that exemptions are in there that need to be in there. So we just have to wait and see what the Senate is going to do. So the exemptions being, like, for instance, they originally came through and said that everybody was going to have some kind of FDA regulation over for food safety assurances, and they were going to have to pay a fee for this. And they said, and they, out of the kindness of their hearts, they were dropping this fee from $1,000 to $500 annually. And we were saying, well, that doesn't matter.
Per farm?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you have 10,000 acres, it's a drop in the bucket. If
exactly
you have
right.
2 acres, it's a lot of money.
Exactly right. So, so we're still trying. I think they're still trying to get that exempted, and I think they did successfully in the House get that exempted for farmers who. So we're looking at exemptions once again for farmers who are selling direct to consumers, that they should be exempted from there. So we need a big part of a tiered system for food safety regulation.
Hmm. So
it just makes sense, because the only growing sector in agriculture, and the USDA realizes this, which is why they've just now started their campaign of Know Your Farmer, even though they're a decade behind everybody else who's been doing this for 10 years, but better late than never, is because, according to their own numbers, there's been 180,000 new farms. And these are farms that they consider under their small, whatever they consider to be small farms.
180,000 new farms in what time frame?
And I think it was in the last 2 years, I would guess, because that's usually the census time frame. It's usually a 2-year period when
Wow.
they do the agricultural statistics census.
Hmm.
And that is a positive agricultural sign. That is a growing sector of agriculture, and it's probably arguably the most diverse section of agriculture, most diverse food system. In the fact of there's a diversity of age ranges, there's more young people coming into farming at these levels.
Mm.
There's women in general are becoming the majority of farmers, and so agriculture is changing. So obviously, regulation and legislation has to change with it.
If the USDA charges $500 per farm to regulate these 180,000 new farms, that's $90 million per year for them.
Mm.
That's pretty attractive.
That's a good point. Yes, that is pretty attractive, isn't it?
So why is there nothing to read about this food safety bill? I thought there was draft legislation.
There's draft legislation, but the proposed exemptions aren't in there, and I don't know why they're not in there yet, unless they're in there now. But as far as I understand, they're not on the website.
Okay, so what else?
Because they were last minute.
What,
they were
what
able
else
to get
would
that
this food
in really
safety?
The day of the voting, from what I understand.
Can you give us just a thumbnail of what this food safety bill is expected to do?
Unfortunately, I cannot. It's been quite a while since I read it.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to misquote something.
Okay. Well, we asked you to talk about Vermont issues, so
yeah,
I was ranging
far. We are all keeping an eye on it.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, it's been on the back burner because healthcare is such the issue in Washington right now. So.
And of course, healthcare has nothing to do with the food that we eat.
That's arguably too that it does.
I don't know if we'll have a chance to get into this with our next guest, Darren Nordahl, who's the author of Public Produce: The New Urban Agriculture. But one of the things that he mentions is the connection between healthcare and food, and it's so strong that he says that Kaiser Permanente, one of the largest healthcare organizations in the country, has recently instituted farmers markets on the hospital grounds of many of their facilities. So now they have 30 farmers markets operating in the parking lots of Kaiser Permanente from Georgia to Hawaii.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So somebody recognizes that connection. We're going to, our next guest on the phone right now, Darren Nordahl. Looking forward to having a conversation about his book with him rather than with you, Brian Moyer. But there's big connections there. Brian Moyer, you just want to sum up what you'd like to be accomplishing now as the new executive director of Rural Vermont.
I'm hoping too that we can build a greater coalition and awareness of local food to live up to the reputation that Vermont has as one of the leading states of local food production and consumption. And but we need to make those avenues much easier for farmers to bring the products to market and for consumers to get them. So that's what my goal is.
We're one of the leading states for purchases at farmers markets, and it still amounts to, what, some $15 or $30 per household per year? Some small amount like that. So we have a long ways to go.
Exactly.
You've got a lot of work ahead of you, Brian Moyer. Well, thanks so much for joining us. And give us your website before you go.
Oh, it's ruralvermont.org.
Ruralvermont.org. Brian Moyer, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm Carl Etnayer. You're listening to Equal Time Radio. And coming right up, we're going to be talking with the author of Public Produce, the New Urban Agriculture that I just gave you a sneak preview of, Darren Nordahl. He's going to be talking about what can be done to let people grow food in the margins of urban areas and why that's so important right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etnayer. Our theme, as usual, is food, energy, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. And today we're really emphasizing the food side of it. And now we're going to be turning to growing food in places that you don't normally think of food being grown. But there are a lot of reasons to do that. There are salmonella scares, obesity concerns, oil scarcity, the need for more local jobs. And Darren Nordahl says the conclusion is clear. It's time to change the way we grow, distribute, and eat food. Darren Nordahl is a city planner and a designer. He's got a new book out just this month that challenges local governments to let people grow food in urban settings. The book is Public Produce: The New Urban Agriculture, from the Department of Planning in Davenport, Iowa. Darren Nordahl, welcome to the show.
Hi, Carl. Thank you for having me.
So, I love this book, and
thank you.
it fits into an agenda that we've been promoting here, and just would love to hear from you what public produce is in your mind, and what drove you to write this book.
It's an agenda that I think that not only fits in your community, but what I'm finding is throughout the country. Before I came to Davenport, I grew up in Berkeley, California, and of course, there's a lot of progressive and innovative thought happening out there on the West Coast, or the Left Coast, as people call it. And it was an idea that I found a lot of success with out there, but didn't think it necessarily had the interest across the country. And it wasn't until I moved to a rural state and an area rich in agricultural heritage where I found out that the desire for local fresh produce was just as strong as it was even in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I was very intrigued and also very heartened to learn this. And the more I started doing research on it, I found that the same was true across the country, that the time has come where the organic movement is ceding to the buy local movement, and people just cannot seem to satiate their hunger for this local fresh produce, especially in a time where the cost of fresh produce is skyrocketing. And as you had mentioned, we are seeing problems with a centralized system of agriculture, with not only how it's distributed and grown, but also the potential foodborne pathogens. So what it really looks at, what public produce is trying to accomplish, is a sort of a decentralization of our agricultural system, to grow it in cities where the majority of the people are living now in America, very near to their places of residence and work and recreation and worship and commerce. So what we're looking at is not something where it is a system of community gardens that's tended on some vacant lots in troubled neighborhoods or in the back corner of a little used park. But it's grown on the public spaces that proliferate throughout the cities, public spaces that we don't often consider when growing food. And that would be streets, such as the boulevards along the sides of streets or even street medians, public plazas, especially in the downtowns. There is usually an abundance of plazas in the downtown areas, our neighborhood parks. And then areas where you can't build anything, floodplains along transportation easements or utility easements. And the difference is that it's not left to the citizens. It's no longer a bottom-up or a grassroots approach to community food security. It's more a top-down approach. What I'm seeing across the country is city officials are recognizing the need for food security options in their communities, and they're being initiated and spearheaded and actually implemented by municipal staff themselves. So it's really public officials utilizing public land for the benefit of the public.
It's public officials using public land, and there are a lot of just citizens involved in the actual tending of the gardens, right?
Yes, and what we see is, and this is something that is challenging. I'm a big proponent of community gardening, but I also recognize its shortcomings. And the shortcomings were really brought to light to me in a book by Mark Winnie, Closing the Food Gap. And the problem is, especially in today's society, is we're finding that people just do not have the time to tend the gardens, and we have a lot of families that are single parent families, a lot of families that need to work two jobs. There's interest in some parts of the city, not so much in the other parts of the city, and these community gardens tend to only erupt on neglected lands that people don't want anyway. Municipal officials tend to grant permission on community gardens in vacant lots in troubled neighborhoods, or as I mentioned before, some part of a park that gets little use. That's a fine place for a community garden. But what we're seeing is that to really address issues of food security and make it available so that it's cheap and convenient for everyone in the city, they really need to be in the places that people pass by on a regular basis, and city officials need to dedicate staff to help maintain some of those edible gardens. And we are seeing that in some of the cities across the country.
That's got to go over like a lead balloon in a lot of places right now with all the economic downturn, the trouble that cities have in meeting their existing chores.
Yeah, and that's tough. One of the easiest things that people cut out in depressed times such as this is food, and it's unfortunate. That should be the one thing that people as individuals and also cities themselves should ensure that in these depressed times that people get adequate nutrition. The problem that we're seeing is since the economic downturn of 2008, the demand in food assistance from food banks has skyrocketed. In some communities, they've seen a 30% increase in demand for food. In places like San Francisco, which is a very, very wealthy part of the country ordinarily, but the problem is that because the cost of living is so high, people do not have adequate disposable income to afford food. They typically cut meals. And unfortunately, 1 in 4 children and 1 in 4 seniors in San Francisco do not get the daily nutritional needs that they require. And it's a bit hypocritical to say that, and it's going to be a tough argument, I realize, but to say that during tough times, we need to ensure people are adequately fed, but then cut staff that could actually help ensure food security for those citizens.
Hmm. Isn't it the case that our model for helping people get access to the food they need is funded at a higher level of government than the cities?
A lot of that is. And the school, the WIC program, Women, Infant, Children, and the school lunch program, school breakfast program, the food stamp program, and that these are programs that have been implemented with varied success, generally not much success throughout the country. And it becomes very difficult. And I think the best model that we've seen is when food security is actually tackled on a local level. And the most recent successful example that I point to in my book is the Victory Garden campaign of World War II. And that's when we were coming out of the Depression, and financial times were very difficult, and we had a large part of our labor force at war, and the demands for the domestic food supply were enormous. And it wasn't the food stamp program or similar programs then that helped provide the nourishment and the food. It was basically a call by the federal government for the local governments and citizens in their community to get together and utilize public lands and private lands and begin to grow food themselves in these smaller gardens. It was no longer centralized. It was a very decentralized form of agriculture, and it was hugely successful. It was 20 million gardens across the country supplied 40% of the nation's fresh vegetable supply. And not only that, but there was the surplus that was generated from the larger farms that went to feed our troops as well as our allies in the war effort. So it was extremely successful. There were a lot of people after the war had ended that really promoted keeping the Victory Garden campaign going. But America was looking in a new direction. They were looking at prosperity on the horizon. They were looking at a new way, technology, a new way of growing plants, a new way of building cities. And we just never looked back until now. We recognize that, you know, many of those efforts in the Victory Garden campaign probably have a lot of lessons to teach and can provide great food security for our nation.
One of the stories that you tell in your book is about something that didn't happen in Davenport, but one of the local restaurateurs would have liked to see it happen. Tell us a story of the Duck City Bistro. I think that's a good example of how you could be growing food in public landscapes without putting more demands on the municipal budget.
Yeah, and this is, and I do want to touch a little bit on different maintenance regimens, but that's a very interesting example. And this was something that's very perplexing to me. We basically have one of the finest restaurants in downtown Davenport, arguably the finest restaurant throughout the entire city, Duck City Bistro. They are adjacent to a downtown plaza, Kaiser Slot Square is what we call it, K-Square. And it's a handsome plaza with a fountain and benches and trees and landscape beds, and the exact sort of civic space that you want in your downtown and throughout your neighborhoods. But again, with municipal staff demands, it was hard to maintain, and the landscape beds were slowly succumbing to the weeds. And this was an eyesore, not just for the public at large, but particularly for the restaurateur whose al fresco section of his restaurant fronts that plaza. And so he came up with an idea where he would enter into an agreement with the city and obtain a conditional use permit, where he would rip out the existing weeds, and he would maintain the beds, and he would like to grow fresh produce that he could then sell in his restaurant. He was looking at basil and mint and varieties of heirloom tomatoes, leeks, as well as a lot of the herbs that he uses in his dishes. Go ahead.
How would he make sure that McDonald's or some other competing restaurant wouldn't go and harvest them?
Yeah, and that's all. Luckily, we don't have any fast food restaurants in downtown Davenport, so I think we're okay there. But that is something that that is brought up is how do you keep other people from pilfering the veggies? But one of the strategies we can talk about this more later is to make sure it's prolific. I mean, there's usually only a monetary incentive to go in and pick someone else's produce. And we see that with community gardens. People who don't have the time or the money to sustain community gardens will take someone else's produce. But the idea is if it's prolific enough in all of the public spaces and it reaches all the neighborhoods, then the demand to go take someone else's produce is lessened. Mm. But anyway, getting back to the restaurateur, it seemed like a win-win situation for the restaurant and for the city. I mean, diners, especially today, want to make sure that the food that they're eating, they want to know the source of that food, and they'd be able to see it grown right before their very eyes, and even harvested right before their very eyes, as the wait staff can go out there and pull the tomatoes before they serve their tomato salad. But the city of Davenport didn't want it. And rather than just come out and say no, what they did was they came in and they pulled the weeds themselves and they planted shrub roses. And the shrub roses are very attractive. But unfortunately, an opportunity was lost. But I will say that the restaurateur did go back out, and in amongst the roses, he did plant his basil and his tomatoes. And so he still does his garden, but without the permission of the city.
Ooh, little guerrilla gardening by a business person.
Yeah, we had a little guerrilla gardening going on in Davenport. That's right.
Wow. If you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Darren Nordahl. He's the author of Public Produce, The New Urban Agriculture. I'm Carl Etnayer. You're listening to Equal Time.
I want to point out we have examples of urban agriculture, of public produce, right here in Vermont.
In Montpelier, on my way here, I stopped in Montpelier and walked by a guerrilla garden that's been going for a bunch of years, I think most of the years since the country store burned down on Main Street. That must have been about 8 years ago. People have a small plot in there, probably no bigger than 10 by 10 or 12 by 12, where a lot of food plants and flowers are grown. Then I walked across the street to the City Hall, and on one side of the City Hall, the teen center there has a garden. The potatoes are harvested now, it looks like, but it's just chock full of tomatoes, and they have escaped the blight. And then, of course, we've talked on this show earlier about the Statehouse Garden, where Vermont became the first state in the nation to plant food on its statehouse lawn. And we're about to have the final harvest of that coming up on Saturday. If you go to the Montpelier's Farmers Market this Saturday, you'll be able to get a pizza slice from the wood-fired oven people there, which is garnished with produce from the Statehouse Garden, the Statehouse Slice. But what
Those
else?
Are excellent examples. I'm in my second edition. I'll have to include Montpelier in that.
Love to have us in there. But what else have you heard of out in Vermont where food is being grown on public landscapes? The Vermont Country Store folks were at the State House early in the summer celebrating the right to dry legislation here, where you can't, if you're a city, you can't prohibit people from putting up clotheslines to dry their food. And they were saying that in the Vermont Country Store land, they have set up gardens where employees can grow food. But what else is out there in Vermont? I don't know. I'd like to hear about that. So, Darren Nordahl, tell us about some other models for growing food in public spaces besides the municipal employees or the restaurateurs.
Well, what I want to do, I do want to touch on, because I do think that maintenance is going to be such a huge concern for a lot of people. I want to talk how different communities can show support for public produce and still tackle some of the issues of the long-term maintenance burdens. One of the most innovative examples occurs in Portland, Oregon. They have a program called City Fruit. And what they do is they plant orchards, usually in public parks or some other public space. And they teach classes on orcharding techniques. And so every couple of weeks, they'll have people come out there, and these classes are sometimes they're free, and sometimes there's a fee for them, depending on the different techniques and whatnot. But one way to maintain the orchard is to have the citizens themselves do it. But at the same time, it's instructional. So they meet out at the orchard, and they learn all sorts of how to espalier, and how to prune, and how to harvest. And at the end, they actually pick all the different fruits, and they make the different ciders out of it. And it's a salubrious end to a food security issue.
Is it sort of like adopt a highway, that you adopt an orchard tree or a section of orchard?
Yeah, it can be. Yeah, but it's the program is run through the Parks Department, and most of the municipalities that I've seen that have adopted some sort of food security program, it is usually through the Parks and Recreation Department. So while they don't have staff to maintain orchards, they do have staff that can lead a class at each orchard, and then the number of attendees, you might have 24 people that show up to these classes. They're the ones that are actually maintaining the orchards through educational lessons. So that, I thought that was a pretty innovative way of doing it.
So that means that there are specific people who you can point to as these are the people who are responsible for these trees.
Yes.
Very good.
Exactly.
Yep.
Leslie Pohl Casbo out of the city of Portland is one person in the Parks and Recreation Department responsible for food security in her city. And Tiva Dawson of the city of Des Moines was responsible for, she was the community food coordinator for the city of Des Moines and led a lot of the food security efforts. And that's very heartening to see that the municipal government is actually setting aside jobs, creating jobs for people to make sure that that the food insecurity issues are dealt with on their community. And a lot of it does have to rely on citizen participation and involvement. But there's often that lack of initiative or commitment from the municipality. And having someone whose job solely is to spearhead these efforts and organize these efforts goes a long way to food security.
So that's one level, Darren Nordahl, at which you can point to a specific person and say, this person is responsible for these trees being kept up at the city staff level. But can that person then point out to specific trees and specific citizens and say, these are the people who signed up to take care of these trees?
Yes. Yeah, and one example is in Des Moines. This tackles more the maintenance concern with fruit trees as an example. Rather than planting fruit trees along streets, which I still contend is a good idea if it's done properly, a lot of parks departments, like the Parks and Recreation Department in Des Moines, plant orchards in park space, and so that if there is fallen fruit, they don't tend to make the mess, nor is it a liability. But what they did was they worked with the Drake neighborhood in Des Moines and to tackle issues of the rising cost of fresh produce, and they got to together. It's like 3 dozen trees of different varieties of fruit, and they planted an orchard in Drake Park. And they teach them how to maintain the trees and how to care for the trees and how to harvest. And then after that, it's up to the residents. And they're the ones that actually maintain the fruit orchard, and they're doing remarkably well.
Examples here in Vermont of agriculture and public landscape. I'll throw out two more. Right next to City Hall, there's a plum tree that I picked a plum from last week and has a fair amount that actually go unharvested that fall on the ground, but it had a fair amount left in the trees. I don't know how many of those are picked and eaten by people. And the Parks Department, and you mentioned Darren Nordahl, the Parks Departments are often responsible for this sort of thing. They planted two new plum trees earlier this year, I believe up in Hubbard Park. I have not made the pilgrimage to visit them yet, but we'll soon have two new trees providing plums to anybody who walks by. Darren Nordahl, what about planting fruit trees right next to the margins of the street so where the fruit can get squished on the sidewalk or the streets? What can you do about that?
Yeah, and this is probably where it's going to take the we'll probably get as much concern, the most concern over this, but it really comes down to a couple of criteria. One is some fruits are just messier than others, and what we have to look at is maybe we're not planting the softer fruits like plums or pears here. Maybe they're the more harder fruits that don't create necessarily so much of a mess. Or the size of the tree at maturity has a lot to do with it. But I think the most effective strategy is to really understand carrying capacity, and something that I get to in my book is you have to gauge the demand and the desire for fresh, free, local produce, and you have to understand the number of people who will typically pass by that space. So you can go to a suburban subdivision and you can plant persimmon trees 40 feet on center, and you can guarantee there'll be a lot of fruit drop on the sidewalks in the city streets. One, because the density of the residents isn't going to be high, and two, because Americans in general just haven't developed a fondness for persimmons like the Japanese have.
Right. Well, we may have a Vermont example here. We're going to go to the phones to Bradford. Bud, welcome to Equal Time.
Yeah, hi, this is Bud over in Bradford. Well, it's not exactly a public space thing, but I also wanted to talk about one of the workshops that's being held in the LEAF, Local Energy Alternatives Festival, this Saturday in Bradford.
Yes,
and
tell us about it.
One of the workshops is alternative lawns. I called it Lawn Be Gone, but that changed to alternative lawns. you know, using part or all of your lawn to grow food or do something other more valuable than just mowing.
And that's this Saturday in Bradford.
This Saturday in Bradford, yeah, 8:30 to 4:30. And there's all kinds of energy workshops, you know, insulating and solar power. And there's some tours of the hydro facility, tours of solar homes, a few other tours, farmway solar tours.
Very good. Well, Bud, thanks so much.
I just want to say one of the things I proposed in our planning meetings was that we use the space where the tent is going to be for the for the vendors to you know, turn some of that lawn space into a growing space. But that didn't work. Maybe next year.
Maybe next year. Okay. Thanks for your call, Bud.
All right. Bye.
Well, Darren Nordahl, we've got about 45 seconds left. What would you like to say to conclude your talk on your book, Public Produce, The New Urban Agriculture?
Well, I think it really comes down to citizen demand and desire. I think you'll find, as I am finding, that municipalities are receptive to the idea and even encourage it, but it has to begin with the citizen demand. I would urge you to contact your councilman and your elected officials and say it is something that you want explored in your city.
Very good. Is there a website connected with this book?
Yeah, it's islandpress.org/publicproduce.
islandpress.org/publicproduce.
Yep.
Darren Nordahl from the Planning Department in Davenport, Iowa, author of Public Produce, The New Urban Agriculture. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Carl. I appreciate it.
I'm Carl Ettenayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday. Don't forget to check equaltimeradio.com for podcasts of the show that Travin and I host, and check out my blog, which is called Relocalizing Vermont. And it's at vtcommons.org/blog. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
In Montpelier, Vermont, I was part of a group that started a vegetable garden on the State House lawn this year. The Obama's garden on the White House lawn was in before ours, but we were proud to be the first state capitol complex with a vegetable garden, at least in recent times. Our final harvest of the season is this week. Food, or the proceeds of the sales of food harvested there, go to the local food pantry. We were by no means the first in Montpelier to use public land in this way. The teen center, located in City Hall, beat us by at least a year in using a little chunk outside of City Hall to grow vegetables. They did it with little fanfare, and it's inconspicuous against the side of the building. It looks like they've harvested the potatoes, but there are still plenty of tomatoes left in the beginning of October. Montpelier's public vegetable gardens are part of a national movement to grow food in public places, according to Darren Nordahl, city designer in Davenport, Iowa. His new book is called Public Produce, The New Urban Agriculture. Nordahl advises cities, towns, and villages that there are many food-growing opportunities beyond traditional community garden plots. There are opportunities to grow foods on land owned by the municipality, like the margins of streets and sidewalks, in parks, squares, and plazas, around parking lots, and at municipal buildings like libraries, municipal offices, and police and fire stations. Nordahl also sees opportunities for growing food around other governmental buildings, like courthouses and schools. He even eyes privately owned spaces where the public is welcome, like churches, businesses, and hospitals. In Nordahl's city of Davenport, Iowa, for example, the parking manager grows food for the public right outside the parking office. Tomatoes, peppers, sage, and thyme are free to be harvested by anyone. The famous Chez Panisse restaurant in Berkeley, California, serves tarts, pies, and pastries, baked with fruit foraged from nearby neighborhoods. In Davis, California, the University of California presses olive oil from the fruit of nearly 2,000 olive trees on campus. When city staff time is devoted to growing food, Nordahl says, urban agriculture can really take off. Municipal staff already plant and maintain public landscapes. Their offices just need to be repurposed to incorporate food production. They've done this in Des Moines, Iowa, and Portland, Oregon, for example. It sounds like the Des Moines program is more focused on helping citizens grow food in the city, while the Portland staff actually maintain city-owned orchards and vegetable gardens. Seattle, New York, and Nashville are other cities which employ people to promote and maintain food production on city land. Who eats the food from public spaces? In many places, like urban fruit trees or the tomatoes, peppers, and herbs at the Davenport Parking Office's garden, the food is free for passers-by to pick. In others, the food production is tended by individuals for their own use. The public benefits from an attractive landscape at no cost to the taxpayers. In other places, like our Statehouse Vegetable Garden in Montpelier, volunteers distribute the food to the food pantry. There are all sorts of reasons to grow more food in our cities. Public Produce cites food security as among the most important. With most of our food coming from far away, and fossil fuel supplies ever more precarious, locally grown food is a hedge against price spikes, or even food shortages. The centralized industrial food system also raises real food safety issues, with food from peanuts to spinach having sickened and killed people in the U.S. in recent years. Decentralizing food production to many urban plots also makes it hard for terrorists to cause widespread havoc with pathogens or toxins in food, the way they could at a food factory processing millions of servings of salad. In the end, growing food plants and trees in the urban landscape is about making more food options available. Fast food, food from the industrial farming system, these are all readily available in cities and towns. What urban dwellers often lack is access to what most humans have had for most of the history of our species: fresh, flavorful, affordable local food. Those municipalities that aren't prepared to devote staff time to growing food can at least let others do it. Nordahl says most cities don't allow fruit and nut trees to be grown in public spaces, and even his own Davenport, Iowa, has zoning laws that prohibit anyone from selling vegetables grown within the city. Nordahl's message is clear. If municipalities aren't going to invest in growing food themselves, they should at least get out of the way and let their residents do it. The newly released book is Public Produce, and it's available at or through locally owned bookstores everywhere. I'm Carl Ettenayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.